From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston.
Your line is now certified for communications with space.
And station, this is WBUR-FM. How do you hear me?
Hello there in Boston. Great to be with you, and welcome aboard the International Space Station.
A celebration of the cosmos today, including a conversation with the ISS. Further afield to Mars, we'll also examine the real-life science behind the fictional vision in the movie The Martian. Plus, one of the little-known but extraordinary women whose fast, hand-cranked mathematical calculations launched America into space.
We were always treated as equals. In my mind, we were partners, we were a team, and they needed us.
It's Radio Boston, first the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Bring engine start. You hear the wee with me, Rick, you promise? Good Lord, ride all the way.
You've got speed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8.
On February 20th, 1962, John Glenn folded himself into the metallic cocoon of the Friendship 7 capsule. He sat on top of a powerful rocket and launched himself into history. The first American to orbit planet Earth.
Cabin pressure coming down nice, 7. Okay, flight very smooth now. Sky looking very dark outside.
I wasn't alive to witness John Glenn's journey as it happened. And I'll admit it, my first real encounter with this monumental moment in space history came in 1986 through Hollywood and the movie Space Camp.
Only a shooting star.
See, right at the start of the movie, there's a scene. A little girl sitting in a wheat field under a sparkling dome of night sky. She cranes her neck up, hoping to see the man-made shooting star of Glenn's Friendship 7 passing overhead.
He winked at me. John Glenn winked at me. I'm going up. I am.
I'm going up. I am. I believed that too when I was a kid. I was going to be an astronaut. I was going to explore space and follow in the footsteps of inspirational giants like Glenn, who proved, as starry-eyed as it sounds, and yes, pun intended, that the pure pursuit of knowledge among the stars was one of humanity's greatest callings, full of the same awe and wonder that Glenn himself felt in 1962 when he first broke through the upper atmosphere and looked back at Earth.
Roger, 0G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
Well, as you already know, John Glenn died this month. He was 95. So in honor of the generations of kids he inspired, and in honor of all the modern space research and exploration that happens right here in the greater Boston area, this hour we're going to listen back to some of our favorite Radio Boston conversations about the final frontier. And we'll start with David Newman. When you were a kid, did you want to be an astronaut?
Probably, yes. I loved space. I was hugely influenced by the Apollo program. What it taught me was I grew up in Montana. So for a young girl growing up in Montana to dream, and spaceflight and exploration are just boundless. And I took that as a call to exploration.
Newman is currently NASA's deputy administrator. She's on leave from MIT, where she's a professor of aeronautics and astronautics. Her lab is helping design the spacesuits that future astronauts will wear on Mars. And in July of last year, she stopped by our studios to talk about space exploration, the challenges she sees as the second in command at NASA, and exactly when we'll realistically be able to launch a manned mission to Mars.
So we're working on it. So kind of two aspects of our journey to Mars for a human mission, where International Space Station is, let's say, kind of the first step, learning for long-duration flight, living in space. Then the next step we call the proving ground. We'll go to cislunar space, further out, longer duration. We have technologies that we have to develop and prove. And then the third phase is actually getting to Mars. So, but we're well on that journey, which is so exciting. And I'd like to point out, too, we're already on Mars. We have orbiters on Mars, and we have rovers on the surface. So all of our robotic precursor missions, we're learning a lot.
But on the other hand, having a human being actually step foot on Mars is orders of magnitude different, right? Way more complicated, way more expensive.
Absolutely. Much more challenging. Yeah. We're in it for the challenging. You know, it's great to have a horizon goal out there. I mean, it's so inspirational.
Could we launch an actual manned Mars mission, say, in 10 years? Is that too ambitious? 15?
Launch it. The actual human mission to Mars is slated for the 2030s. So okay. It's a couple decades up. But we have, you know, that we have that much work to get there to stay on that schedule, absolutely. Like I said, we're going to go to the middle proving ground. Right now, we're Earth-reliant, you know, communications and food and supplies. At Mars, we're really completely Earth-independent. So that's kind of how we have it in those three phases.
Yeah. I mean, I want to talk more about the science and the scientific challenges in just a second. But now that you are the number two person at NASA, you know, politics kind of intrudes. What's your response to people who say, too ambitious, cost too much, it's not where NASA should be focusing its efforts?
I politely disagree. It's exactly where NASA and our government, and I think all of us as just private citizens, the investment is very small. I think it's worth it. We do have to be very judicious for the budget that we have. But again, we're making the technology developments. We can live with the budget that we have, so we have to be very judicious in the investments, and it is one step at a time, and it really is an investment for NASA, but also, again, like I say, for humanity, for inspiration.
So tell me more about that. I mean, why does Mars matter in your mind, in your heart?
We will be interplanetary species. I definitely believe that, and we're going scientifically to look for past evidence of life on Mars. So, yes, it's a stretch goal, but it's the right goal for NASA as the horizon goal. And the whole world, it's really a global, I look at it as a global exploration journey.
Yeah. Can we talk for a minute about the research that you were doing at MIT? I mean, because you were really developing exciting new technologies for something which is absolutely essential for human space travel, and that is the spacesuit, right? So, I mean, what was the biggest challenge, or what is the biggest problem with the current spacesuits that astronauts use right now?
I call it, actually, the world's smallest spacecraft. And the reason I call it that is it's a human inside the suit, but you have to be provided every single system to keep you alive.
I mean, it's the only thing that's protecting an astronaut from the vacuum and vastness of space.
Exactly.
Those few layers.
That's it. You need a spacesuit to keep alive in the vacuum of space. And challenges that I've kind of concentrated on are how do we make them really mobile? My vision is making you an Olympic athlete, empowering you. I want you to be an explorer on the surface of Mars with absolute mobility. I don't want the suit to encumber you.
Yeah. You know, I back in high school, I went to Space Camp, Space Academy. It was actually a really, really fantastic experience back when I did want to be an astronaut. And I got a chance to actually wear one of the suits, an old suit, of course, that they had decommissioned, you know, the Michelin Man ones that we're all familiar with. And it was a fantastic experience, but I got sort of a firsthand feeling about how hard it is to actually move in them. I mean, I was in a giant water tank, so simulated low-gravity environment. But you really have to work hard to move your fingers and your arms and, you know, even grab, like, something simple like a wrench. The suits that you've been developing are really, really different. I mean, first of all, I think they're pretty much, like, on top of your skin. Right?
Yeah,
it's more like a leotard than a Michelin Man suit.
Exactly. So we use the concept in that research of mechanical counterpressure. So you apply the pressure. It's the same pressure. We need a third of an atmosphere, which is about 30 kilopascals or 4.3 psi, whatever unit you like. But it's about a third of an atmosphere. Can we do that? So that was our big technological challenge. Can we do that and apply it directly to the skin?
Yeah.
And so far, that's research and development. It seems that it's technically feasible, which is the great news, still needs a lot more development.
Mm. So that's a science and technology that obviously has applications to Mars missions and, you know, maybe even sooner than that, because as you've mentioned, we have the International Space Station up and in orbit right now. But what about unmanned missions that NASA has been undertaking in recent years? I mean, there have been quite a few successes there. What are some of your favorites?
Well, right now, I have to talk about New Horizons mission to Pluto. It's our last planet in the solar system, really.
Technically not a planet anymore, though, right?
It's debatable. Let's say we have data now from all the, you know, 9 planets in the solar system. The images, the celebration. You know, it's taken almost a decade to get there.
Yeah. But if I may, as an American, I have to say I was a little disappointed that the Europeans beat us to landing on a comet and NASA didn't pull it off first.
Okay, so that's a good point. But let's see. So NASA is leading, and we want to be the international leaders, of course, leading International Space Station future. But it's also, right, we partner, and we're really proud, and we celebrate. We have such close ties with our European colleagues, friends. And so don't we want them to be first on a few things, too? You know, so again, I don't think we need to lead everything. I love to see first happening in kind of all the spacefaring nations, and there's more to come. That's the exciting thing for the
more
future.
More nations.
More nations, absolutely.
Okay. Well, so you mentioned partnerships. And that is one thing about how NASA is changing that I did want to talk with you about, because NASA is, for example, partnering with private space exploration companies, SpaceX being one of them, in order to do what NASA used to always do in-house.
That's exactly to plan. That's exactly what we need to do.
But is it the right thing to do? I mean, because I feel like a lot of space purists don't want private companies. What they worry about is the privatization of space.
Yeah, this is a public-private partnership. Much better that private companies do this, and NASA can get on with our business too of exploration. You know, we have constrained budgets and limits and things like that. So it really makes sense. These public-private partnerships are absolutely critical. That is the future of exploration.
Hmm. So Dr. Newman, here we are. It's July. And of course, July is always a big month in terms of NASA anniversaries. And I was just calculating that it was 46 years ago on July 20th that Apollo 11 and Neil Armstrong put the first human footsteps on the moon. And I think back to the speed with which that happened, right, from President Kennedy's announcement to a mere 9 years later in 1969, the moon landing happened. Do you ever wish for that same kind of speed, and do you think that we have that same sort of national desire to push to Mars?
I love the question. Of course, I'm an eternal optimist, so I think we do have the will of the people for exploration, and the next push will be to Mars. So I think we need to really kind of capitalize on that. We have to do a different era, different time. So we do it in different ways, different partnerships, different models, much more reduced budgets. But the inspiration and the will to explore and just the human desire, I think it's there, and we need to tap into it. So everyone should be dreaming, I think, just like I was a young person when I looked up at, you know, Apollo and saw that landing, the moon. And so, you know, who are going to be the first people on Mars? And I sure hope it's a great American boy or girl that's listening to this interview today.
Would you go if you could?
I would go. I would definitely go to Mars. And you know the good thing about that? I might fit into the elderly category of astronauts going to Mars, right? Because take someone that's older, you don't have to worry as much about the radiation problems and things like that.
Dava Newman, NASA's deputy administrator, speaking to us last July when she first took the post. Newman was in town last year for the International Space Station Research and Development Conference. Now, the ISS itself is about the size of a football field, has about the same internal volume as a 747, and speeds around the Earth at around 15,500 miles per hour. Back in 2013, Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks got quite the treat. He spoke with an astronaut aboard the ISS as it zoomed 200 miles overhead. Navy Captain Chris Cassidy was born in Salem, Massachusetts, and when he's on terra firma, he calls York, Maine home. He's the 500th person to walk in space, and during his career, he spent more than 180 days in space. And in 2013, NASA connected Cassidy and the ISS with Anthony Brooks here on the ground.
Mission Control reports that your line is now certified for communications with space.
And station, this is WBUR-FM. How do you hear me?
Hello there in Boston. Great to be with you, and welcome aboard the International Space Station.
Hey, Commander Cassidy, it's Anthony Brooks in Boston. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful to have you. And I got to say, this is the first time my voice has been in outer space, as far as I know. So I'm very excited about this interview.
Well, Anthony, it sounds just like it does in Boston, I think.
Let me ask you this, Commander Cassidy. When you return home next month, you will have been in space for 6 months, which is, I think, hard for a lot of people on Earth to imagine what that feels like. What's the biggest challenge about being away from Earth for so long?
There's several ways to answer that question. One is on the personal level. You know, we miss our family and friends and our loved ones on the ground, and that's a big part of it. We're all of us that are up here when it's time to return. That's one of the first things we think about is our family, friends, and loved ones. Second to that would be some of the pleasant things that each of us have on Earth. For me, it's been the summertime right now, so I realize that I've missed the smell of fresh-cut grass and, you know, just being outside in the summertime and going to the beach and that sort of thing. So those types of things that you can just do on Earth are a few of the examples that I'm really looking forward to when I get back.
Hmm. Commander Cassidy, quick question. You know, we're following where you are right now online, and I think when I started talking to you, you were somewhere over Senegal. I'm wondering if you can just give me a sense of your view. What are you seeing? What do you see when you look out the window?
The best way for me to describe it is if 200, 250 miles above the surface of the Earth, for instance, we can see all of Florida when we're over it. You see the whole state of Florida and partially up the East Coast. When we come across the Mediterranean, as we go through the Straits of Gibraltar, you can see Italy and its boot. And when you come across the Persian Gulf, you can see all the sand that's all around that whole region, and then the really beautiful, lush green Nile River Delta. So there's some really breathtaking views to be seen on our planet.
Well, speaking of breathtaking views, Commander, I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about what it's like to walk in space.
There's really not much walking involved. In fact, our legs just sort of drag along and don't do much of anything. It's all done with your hands. So it's hand over hand across a path of handrails. And we always have a safety tether connected back to the airlock hatch. It's kind of like a dog leash with a little slow pull. So if you fell off, nobody ever has, and we don't want to test it, but if you did, it would pull you slowly back to where the airlock hatch is. As we go around the Earth every 90 minutes, 45 minutes in the day, you see the Earth below you, dangling beneath your feet, and at night you see absolutely nothing, total pitch darkness. So it's really an interesting place to work.
But what's it like the first time you step out into space? I've got to imagine that it's like stepping off of a mountaintop or off of a skyscraper. Is there part of you that has to sort of suck it up and just sort of say, take the plunge, man, take the plunge?
You know, that's exactly right. I was just telling the folks before I was talking to you that my experience was as if I had just walked up to the edge of the skyscraper and tilted my head over the side, and my brain was telling me, no, what are you doing? You're too close. In fact, this is a kind of a funny story. On my very first spacewalk on my shuttle mission, there happened to be a piece of a drink straw that had floated into our airlock, and when I opened the hatch, this piece of trash, the drink straw, flew right past my head, and I saw it go out of the corner of my eye, and then I watched it kind of spiral its way down to the Earth, and I remember thinking, I don't want to be that drink straw, so hold on tight.
The first time you went into space, you traveled aboard a U.S. space shuttle. This last time you rocketed into space on a Russian rocket, you'll be returning home with the Russians. How does that compare with the U.S. shuttle? What's that experience like?
Well, first and foremost, all the books are in Russian, and there's a guy talking to you on the other side of the radio who's speaking in Russian, unlike in the shuttle where all the books are in my native language and the guys on the radio are all speaking English. So that was one hurdle to get over. But aside from that, it's really more about the size of the vehicles. I would equate the space shuttle to be like a big pickup truck, King Cab pickup truck, lots of cargo in the back. Kind of a nice cushier ride, whereas the Soyuz is a small little race car, you know, where you just get the people and a soft bag of toiletries or something that can go along on your trip. And then because of that, when you're driving a sports car, for instance, you feel all the turns. And I remember on this most recent launch, right off the pad, the vehicle tried to vector in on its heading. I could feel those small little course changes. Whereas in the shuttle, it's such a more massive vehicle. I don't remember feeling those quick nuances in the heading changes. So quite different because of the mass of the vehicle. And then coming home will be a lot different because we'll land under parachute in the Soyuz, and on the space shuttle it was much like an aircraft landing with wings on a runway. So a couple key differences. Neither one is more right or wrong. They're just different. And I'm really thankful to have both experiences.
That's astronaut Chris Cassidy speaking with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks back in August 2013. There's more ahead in this special space exploration edition of the show. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Welcome back to a special space exploration edition of Radio Boston. Before the break, we checked in with NASA and heard from the International Space Station orbiting our planet. But now we want to visit a topic that's much further afield. Black holes.
It is the most bizarre celestial creature, I would say, in the entire universe. Something that is several solar masses could collapse to a point and then put around itself this boundary that if you enter, you cannot get out.
That's MIT science writer Marcia Bartuszek speaking with us last year about her book, Black Hole, How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. Now, her book isn't so much an astrophysical exploration, but rather the history of an idea. So we started with the idea behind what we think black holes actually are.
They are the ultimate death of a massive star. And what happens is the star literally runs out of fuel. In a second, the core collapses to a point, and the gravity is so strong that it brings everything in and lets nothing out.
We can't see them or observe them directly. Is that true?
We see them when they're near matter. And when that matter gets attracted to the black hole, it doesn't just plummet right away into the black hole. It takes a while. Like, it's often been described like traffic coming to the parking lot of a football stadium at a big game. The matter starts swirling around the hole, and it takes a while to get eaten. As it's falling towards the hole and spiraling in, it generates great energies. And that's what we see.
And why is it that scientists or astrophysicists believe black holes are so very important to our understanding of the universe?
It's only within, I would say, the last decade where they are now acknowledging that there is a supermassive black hole containing the mass of millions, even billions of suns in the center of every major galaxy.
Including our own.
Including our own. Ours is about 4 million solar masses. But now they're wondering, if there's a supermassive black hole in every galaxy, does that mean that that is central to the construction of a galaxy? It may be that our very existence depends on that supermassive black hole helping a galaxy form.
You write in your book that this is the story, the history of an idea. And so let's go back to the first time where the idea of a thing that came to be known later as a black hole was first even posited, right? And so by a man named John Mitchell, who I have to say I had never even really heard of. Who is John Mitchell in the 18th century?
No one knows of him today. But he was described by historians as one of the most inventive scientists of the 18th century. He was a mathematician, a geologist, and also an astronomer. And he had imagined in 1786, what if a star were 500 times as wide as the sun, but just as dense throughout? And using Newton's law of gravity, he figured that light would not be able to escape from the star. And it went nowhere, but it didn't regenerate until Einstein entered the scene in the 20th century with his new theory of gravity.
And just to remind people, one of the reasons why Einstein, as a young man, was interested in what then later on became to be his theories of relativity was that he basically said, hey, there's a problem here. We've got Newton's laws on one hand about gravity, and then we've got Maxwell's laws on the other hand about electromagnetism. And the two don't exactly link up the way they should. That's what got him thinking about
that. It's not often put that way, but that was the central point of Einstein going after this problem, is They were the only great theories at the time, and they didn't mesh. And it led to his total reinvention of Newton's law of gravity.
So what does it all have to do with black holes then?
Well, just weeks after Einstein introduced his theory in November 1915, a German astronomer named Karl Schwarzschild got the first full solution. This made Einstein ecstatic. He thought this was a great accomplishment. But the first inkling that there could be something like a black hole came out of Schwarzschild's equations, and it flummoxed everybody.
Everybody.
Even Einstein.
Yeah, so this is what really gets me, right? Because here we have Albert Einstein, you know, the genius of astrophysics of the 20th century. He even thought this concept of black holes was too preposterous to believe.
Because at that time, to be fair, there were no observations. It was all
there
on
paper.
There
weren't any observations of what relativity could show us either.
That's true. Well, he had a few experiments there, the bending of light, which, you know, said that he was on the right track. You have to remember, this was an era where no one thought the universe acted in such a preposterous way.
Yeah. So this is one of the themes which I feel kind of comes up again and again in your book. And that is that in our understanding, or the evolution of our understanding of what black holes are, we come upon these sort of milestones in the history of science where someone has this burst of scientific creativity and imagination. And then our powers of observation catch up to that moment of imagination.
And that's what happened here, is Einstein literally came up with a theory out of pure intuition, but it needed decades more for the experiments and observations to take place to really prove it.
I have to say, I mean, this is going to sound full of hubris, but I don't really blame Einstein, because even as we're talking about it now,
it is really, really, really difficult in the sort of, I don't know, clumsy limits of my own imagination to
say honestly that I can fathom what it means for a star to collapse down to a point. I'm not sure I really understand what that means.
And they're not really sure as yet. They won't really know exactly what happens to that matter until they get a full theory of quantum gravity. I think that's what Einstein was railing against. Singularities in physics is a big fat sign that something is wrong here. And in fact, the dean of American General Relativity, John Wheeler, got into looking at black holes, trying to get rid of them, because he thought he could solve it and find out what was really happening there. And all he proved to himself was black holes do exist.
So just briefly, singularity, is this another word for black holes? Should we not even
be
calling them black holes?
They are. At the center is where all the matter goes, is called a singularity.
Okay. Now, in the title of your book, we have the Newtonians, we have Einstein, and you also mentioned Stephen Hawking. What role does he play in the story of black holes?
Well, he did place a bet with Kip Thorne. That was the gamble. When they recognized what they thought was the first black hole called Cygnus X-1, Kip Thorne bet that it was a black hole. Hawking was still cautious. He bet against. But after 16 years, they made the bet in the mid-1970s. By 1990, Hawking cried uncle. But he decided to look at the black hole from the perspective of an atom, and it changed how we thought about the black hole. When you are looking at the event horizon from the atomic viewpoint, it's a turmoil of particles. And he actually concluded that black holes evaporate.
I want to just go circle back to where we started, and the idea that a concept in science really has arrived when it's just even in the popular culture. You know, I had to bring up Star Trek. So here's a scene from Star Trek Voyager.
They may be trapped in the event horizon. Open a channel. This is Captain Catherine Janeway of the starship Voyager to the vessel near the quantum singularity. Do you need help?
Event horizon?
A singularity is a star that's collapsed in on itself. The event horizon is a very powerful energy field surrounding it.
It looks like it's being pulled in toward the singularity. We have to get it out of the event horizon.
So that's a scene from Star Trek Voyager. This was the high school brain bender for me. What if you did get pulled into a black hole?
Well, from the classical perspective, you would get stretched like a noodle. You would be noodleized because of the tidal forces. You know, you would just be torn up into subatomic particles. There is a quantum view, though, the speculation at this point, that instead of entering this zone where you go right to the singularity, that you'll actually hit a firewall of tumultuous particles and space and time breaking up. But that's only speculation. They won't know until they get a full theory of quantum gravity.
MIT science writer Marcia Bartuszak, speaking with us in May 2015 about her book, Black Hole, How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. There's more ahead. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special space exploration edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Pressurization start. X plus 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
That's the sound of the Jupiter C rocket, launching on January 31st, 1958. It carried Explorer 1, the first American satellite successfully placed in Earth orbit. Now, there was a group of little-known, extraordinary women whose fast, accurate, and hand-cranked mathematical calculations provided essential support for America's earliest push into space. Boston author Nathalia Holt tells their story in her book, Rise of the Rocket Girls, The Women Who Propelled Us from Missiles to the Moon to Mars. These amazing women worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, and as Holt tells it, at the time, the women were working as computers.
JPL put out advertisements, computers wanted, and many of the women found out about the jobs that way. And then there was a woman supervisor named Macy Roberts, who was made supervisor in 1942, and she is the one that decided it should be an all-female team.
Okay, so tell us then more about the team and exactly what it did. Because, you know, I mean, I feel like I should just underscore here. We're talking about putting objects, satellites, and then later on human beings in space at a time where, I mean, the computational power of your iPhone, one iPhone is like a million times more than the existing machine computational power we had back in the 50s and 60s. So the importance of doing these hand calculations and doing them accurately can't really be overemphasized, right?
Yes, absolutely. It would take an entire day for the women to do a single trajectory of the rockets they were working on.
Now, you mentioned that they were called computers. Why weren't these women called engineers?
So there weren't very many women engineers at the time. So there are women that applied who had degrees in engineering. But what's really inspiring about this group of women is that they did later become engineers, and they really became the first computer programmers in the lab as well.
Well, so you mentioned a minute or two ago about a very key woman in all of this who was a supervisor of one of these teams, can I call it? Her name's Macy Robert, is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about Macy. Who was she? How did she become such a key figure at JPL?
So she was just very trusted by the founders of JPL. She started working for them very early on, and she was made supervisor because she was a little bit older than most of the other people there. It was still a very small kind of family group, so she was sort of seen as the mother hen. And she just decided that she wanted to hire all women because she wanted to have the lab keep its family feel.
In the book, you write that all it took was for her to see a man's name on an application, she would automatically reject it.
Yes. Today, this would be a lawsuit. Then it was okay.
Well, Nathalia, if you could just hang on for one second. I want to bring in someone who you spoke to who's part of this story. Her name is Susan Finley. She's currently a systems engineer at NASA. She's NASA's longest-serving woman and started as a human computer at JPL in Pasadena back in 1958. Susan Finley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
It's such a privilege to have you on this show. I am always so excited to speak with America's earliest pioneers in all their forms. So tell us, what first attracted you to working at JPL?
Well, because I was working at Convair as a computer, and it was 30 minutes away, and I had just gotten married, and my husband had graduated from Caltech, and he knew about the lab that Caltech had, called JPL. So I went there and applied, and they needed a computer. So they hired me right on the spot.
Yeah, and so I'm sorry, Susan, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'm curious because, of course, I'm looking at this story from 2016 eyes, of course, and I just want to wonder, like, were gender differences obvious in the office? I mean, this was the 50s. I'm thinking Mad Men. They must have been. But, I mean, did it matter that you were a woman? I mean, how did the fact that you were a female computer play out in your daily work at JPL?
Interestingly enough, both at Convair and at JPL, we were always treated as equals. In my mind, we were partners, we were a team, and they needed us. So I won't say that about secretaries. I think secretaries have always had a problem, but the computers didn't.
Mm. Well, Nathalia, you tell a story in the book Rocket Girls about one of the first projects that Susan worked on at JPL, the launch of Pioneer 3. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
We had just gotten a little tiny desk computer with that you programmed with wires. For some reason, it wouldn't work that night, so they called me in to do the hand calculations, and we would get the information over the telephone about the telemetry that the rocket was sending. And then I would figure out what its escape velocity was. I would just, every new number, I would plug it in, and then the man standing behind me would call it over the radio to them, or the phone to them. And then we knew what the escape velocity had to be to get out of the atmosphere, and it kept slowing down and slowing down. And so we knew it wasn't going to make it.
Susan, hang on for just a second, because I want to bring Nathalia Holt back into the conversation. So tell us more about this moment and what it tells us about the importance of the women who were doing these calculations.
Yes, yeah, so Pioneer 3, Explorer 1, all of these early moments in NASA's history, they were just so critical to have the women there. They were part of developing the rockets, developing the fuel, and actually calculating the trajectories and mission control when they were happening.
Susan, I'm seeing that the problem with the Pioneer 3 was that there was a third stage malfunction, so it never reached the escape velocity that it needed?
Yes, I guess so. We didn't know what the problem was at the time, of course.
So tell me a little bit about, and Nathalia, please feel free to jump in here anytime. There's some things I feel that never change, and one is the challenges of balancing work and family life. How did that work for you, Susan, in your earliest days at JPL?
That certainly was the biggest challenge, and it still is a challenge because the United States still doesn't have support for working families as far as the children go.
Mm. Well, so did you feel that you got some kind of support from Macy Roberts, who we were talking about earlier, because she created this special team where it was at least all women working together?
Well, that was a lot easier then. I didn't have children then, but I still had a husband to take care of. And yes, it was very nice to have people to commiserate with.
Susan Finley, tell us a little bit more about how your work evolved and grew from those early days in 1958 at JPL. Because as you probably heard, I asked Nathalia a little earlier, why is it that women at that time weren't called engineers, they were called computers? I mean, was there a point at the time where you realized or you knew that you should have had the title of engineer?
I guess I never thought that because I did not graduate from college. I only took a couple of math courses. And so I didn't feel that, especially that I deserved it, but I certainly was doing work at that level. And the third time I came back to work at JPL, they did hire me in as an engineer because I had had 4 years of experience on the job and I had learned a lot. But then they decided about, I think it's 12 years ago now, that anybody without a degree couldn't be an engineer.
Wait, so I want to be sure I'm understanding this correct. Your title is engineer.
I'm a system engineer, yes. And I said that. I said, but that's what I do. And they said, well, that doesn't matter.
Wait, so is your title not officially engineer at NASA right now?
That's true.
Are you serious?
I am serious.
You've been working for NASA or for the American Space Program since 1958.
Yes, yes.
I'm agog right now.
That's right. I officially engineering work. I get to put it on my, well, I haven't taken it off of my business card.
Nor should you. Well, Natalia Holt, that was unexpected, Susan, but Natalia Holt, we've just got about a minute here left to go. Tell us what you think the story of Susan and the other Rocket Girls. Tell us about the role of women overall in terms of where we were and how far we've come. When it comes to not just space, but I mean, we're talking science and technology fields because, you know, once again, they are as important as ever.
Yes. So these are women that have had long careers at NASA. They've touched just about every mission you can think of. And they're important to us as role models for women. You know, right now, women in technology are facing a really difficult time. What we've seen is that in 1984, 37% of bachelor's degrees in computer science were awarded to women. And today that number has dropped to 18%. So it's a desperate time for women that are interested in computers and are interested in math. And it's important that we recognize our pioneers because they deserve the recognition. Certainly Sue Finley deserves much more recognition than she's received, and so do the other women, but also because of what they can bring for the next generation of women.
Natalia Holt is a Boston-based science writer and author of Rise of the Rocket Girls. And Sue Finley, the longest-serving woman at NASA, where she's currently a systems engineer and working on NASA's Juno mission. And by the way, the Juno mission is currently orbiting Jupiter right now and beaming back data from the planet. Well, finally, I want to loop back to where we began this hour, to that feeling of awe and wonder that John Glenn experienced when he first looked back on planet Earth during his historic orbit in 1962.
Roger, zero-G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
That right there, I think, is why we do it. That breathtaking majesty that comes with discovery, with a better understanding of our place in the universe. It's why NASA is working hard on a future manned mission to Mars, which will be historic, while also costly, complicated, and dangerous. Now, those risks were brilliantly captured in the 2015 movie, The Martian.
I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years' worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist. Mars will come to fear my botany powers.
Matt Damon there as astronaut Mark Watney in The Martian. He's got to figure out how to grow crops after being abandoned on the red planet. And the movie depicts a lot of space science in action, some accurate, some not so accurate. So back in February, we fact-checked The Martian movie with an actual scientist who studies Mars and an actual astronaut who'd been in space. Here's that conversation with MIT astrophysicist Michael Hecht and astronaut Jeffrey Hoffman. I truly love my job. This is so great. All right, so let me first ask you, if there were an Oscar for most scientifically accurate film, would The Martian be in the running?
I'd say it was pretty good, not perfect. I'd give it a B on a rating scale. They did a really good job in most things. There were a few things, for instance, that scene at the end where Matt Damon pokes a hole in his glove so that he can propel himself over.
Hold
to...
that thought, actually,
okay.
Jeff Hoffman, because we have that scene here queued up. Now,
well, I have to say that was bogus. So I'll just say that before you play the
spoiler,
scene.
Spoiler, it's bogus.
Just so that people know what's coming.
All right, so this is a scene where Matt Damon, who plays Mark Watney, he's in orbit in the Mars Ascent Vehicle, but too low.
Close, but not close enough.
So he can't reach the Hermes spaceship, and this is his solution. So let's listen.
I can find something sharp in here and poke a hole in the glove of my EVA suit. I could use the escaping air as a thruster
and fly towards you. It would be easy to control because it'd be on my arm.
I can't see you have any control if you did that. You'd be eyeballing the intercept using a thrust vector you can barely control.
Yes, yes, those are all very good points. But consider this. I'd get to fly around like Iron Man.
Wouldn't he also
Commander?
Be dead?
Let's go Iron Man.
Oh, let's go
well,
Iron
you know,
Man.
That's a very cool concept. On the very first U.S. spacewalk, Ed White had a little reaction control gun, which he held in his hand to try to control himself.
But that was like a separate thruster that he
held
in his hand.
But he had a lot more control than Matt Damon would have had with a hole in his glove, and it was totally out of control. So, as I say, bogus. But it's a movie, as you say. Yeah. You know, it's
well,
a movie.
Let me ask Professor Heck here a question, because get us back to this point. This is like a major plot point in the movie that, you know, Matt Damon or Mark Watney is a botanist. He's going to grow food to help him survive on Mars. The way they show it in the film, is there any aspect of it that's close to scientifically accurate?
Well, I think most of it is actually remarkably close. I'm not sure I even agree with Jeff in terms of the reaction to the Iron Man scene, only for a different reason.
Oh, okay.
Not because it's not correct. It isn't correct. But I love it when a film finds a way to slip in a little bit of education. And if they just got across the idea of action and reaction in space, you know, that's a good thing. And, you know, they simplified it a little bit to make it not physical. I would say the same thing with growing plants. Jade, basically, yes, you certainly could grow plants on Mars more or less the way he talks about it. Would it be edible? There are some toxicity issues. You know, in my mind, I'll let that sort of thing slip in the cause of artistic license. I'll tell you what I wouldn't, though,
okay.
What I wouldn't let
okay.
slip. The only part of the film, and it wasn't so much the book that bothered me, you know, Mars is my second favorite planet. It's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful, stark desert landscape with, you know, puffy blue clouds and a pink sky, and it's familiar, yet it's foreign. And it's hostile in many ways, but one thing you can't accuse it of is having a hostile weather. It has gentle breezes that can lift dust to great heights, but wouldn't knock over a lawn chair.
Really? And, I mean, a giant storm is what's the premise of the entire film.
NASA, I've spoken with some friends at NASA who collaborated with and tried to help out the Martian to make it as accurately as possible. And they tried to come up with alternate scenarios that would force the evacuation from the surface of Mars. Unfortunately, none of them turned out to be as cinematographically impressive as the dust storm, and so the movie stayed with the dust storm. But as we say, it's a movie.
Now, if I can, the other piece of this that was very realistic is the technology that enabled Mark Watney, Matt Damon, to survive to begin with was the ability to take Martian carbon dioxide and turn it into oxygen, whether it was for breathing or for inflating his habitat or for burning the fuel that would get that MAV off the surface. That technology is very similar to the technology that Jeff and I have been developing for the Mars 2020 mission.
How lucky we
are to have Matt Damon as a spokesman for our experiment. Who can claim that?
So you guys bring up a point which leads me to one last clip that I want to play from the movie.
Go for it.
And it's about sort of not just in terms of scientific facts, but sort of the spirit of science that is in this film, because it seems like so much science fiction is all about science going wrong, right? Like dystopian scientific futures. But in The Martian, I feel like there's a lot of scenes or subtext here where, you know, the astronauts are basically saying how much they love the idea of exploration, how much they want to further and love science. And in fact, there's even a scene where Mark Watney, Matt Damon again, asks his commander to tell his parents about his journey, of course, if something happens to him. And he says something really moving, and here's what he says.
Tell them I love what I do. And I'm really good at it. I'm dying for something big and beautiful. And greater than me. Tell them I said I can live with that.
So, I mean, was that meaningful
oh,
to you?
Oh, very, very deeply. I mean, you know, as an astronaut, I had to deal with that. I mean, you're sitting, you're strapping yourself on top of 4.5 million pounds of high explosives
that you
every
can't
time
turn
you're
off.
Ready to go into
yeah.
space. But when we were getting up ready on my fourth mission to go and rescue the Hubble Space Telescope, which was probably the most significant of all my missions, you know, the realization that, that this is worth the risk. This is something that's important to do. It's going to make a big difference to science, to people all over the world. And as it turned out, it did. I mean, the Hubble telescope has been NASA's greatest scientific success. So I very much resonate with what Matt Damon said there.
That's MIT's Jeffrey Hoffman and Michael Hecht. We spoke with them back in February for our special series on the making of The Martian. Well, that's it for this special space edition of Radio Boston. There is only one thing left to say.
Live long and prosper.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.